Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast, your weekly dose of talking about watching soccer on TV, online and apps. Coming up on episode 30, we reveal who will be Fox's lead commentary team for the upcoming matches at next summer's World Cup already, as well as discussing the latest news from Fox and Telemundo about the Confederations Cup coverage, the viewing numbers for last weekend's Champions League final, plus our thoughts on the impact that David Beckham's Miami team could have on MLS. And we've got feedback from you in our listener mailbag. My name is Christopher Harris, aka The Gaffer, and I'm joined by Kartik Krishnaiyer. Kartik, who is looking to go for his coaching badges, so I hear.
Yeah, I'm thinking that'll probably deepen my understanding of the sport as an analyst. Now, it's funny, since I've made that announcement publicly, more and more people are telling me I should go for my referee badges and take a referee course or two, because through the years, myself included, so many in our industry have been critical of referees without really knowing what a referee sees, or the depth perception they have, or the angles, or the latest FIFA mandates on officiating. So that's interesting. Maybe that's something I'll do down the road.
It was so long ago, Kartik, that I took I can't remember if it was a coaching the coaching F license or if it was the referee's license. But this is going back. This is before the 1994 World Cup. So early 90s, I remember taking it, and I passed it, but I'm sure I have the certificate someplace, but it's so long ago I can't even remember what it was. So, but no, I think it's a good idea, and I think anyone in the soccer business, especially talent too, for a lot of these we'll be talking about it in a little bit, for a lot of these broadcasters should go and get their coaching badges to have a better understanding of the game, not just from the rules perspective, but the intricacies of the game itself. So for those listeners who haven't had a chance to listen to the World Soccer Talk podcast before, what we're about. So if you've never listened before, it's a podcast that focuses on the soccer media coverage. So it kind of dives deep into analyzing how well or how not so well some of these broadcasters are doing in covering the beautiful game for us from around the world onto our TV sets and streaming devices. So let's kick off first, Kartik, by asking you what you've been watching this past week.
Yeah, obviously, like everybody else, watched the UEFA Champions League final on Friday. I have to say, from a soccer perspective, football perspective, was a little bit disappointed by Juventus, particularly in the second half. Really expected that back three to lock down Real Madrid. I know a lot of us had deluded ourselves into believing that that Juventus's back three was as good as Real Madrid's attack, right? And that proved not to be the case. So obviously, like everybody else, watched that. Been dosing heavy on the FIFA U20 World Cup. Watched the Mexico-England quarterfinal. Watched the USA-Venezuela quarterfinal. That went 120 minutes. Watched the Italy-Zambia quarterfinal. That went 120 minutes. And then now England and Italy just concluded, as we record this, in the semifinal, England winning 3-1. Really, the core of that England team is an Everton core, and we always hear about how great Everton's academy is, right? Mm-hmm. That's been a talking point a lot on NBC's Premier League coverage. The guys that have been stars from Everton in this tournament, Calvert-Lewin, Lookman, they're players that I think people who watch the Premier League week in and week out are familiar with. They're guys that Ronald Koeman had kind of Calvert-Lewin they actually bought from Sheffield United, remember, Sheffield Wednesday, remember. But they're guys that Ronald Koeman has bled into their team recently and has been able to really make quite impactful in terms of first-team action. So I think that's part of the reason England typically has talented teams at youth tournaments. They tend to have teams that perform well at youth tournaments, but they're performing even better at this tournament, I think, because they have enough guys. Amoa from Spurs, Ojo from Liverpool, that have gotten enough game time, a lot of cases in cup game matches, but still have gotten enough game time at top clubs that it's making a difference. And then Solanke has been a big star, and he's a player that has come through Chelsea's system and is doing really well in this World Cup.
Well, for me, Kartik, it was I was watching mostly a lot of international friendlies this past week. Of course, the Champions League final too. My week started off watching, this is going back over a week ago now, the Mexico against Ireland match and the friendly. Felt kind of sorry for Ireland in this one because you know that this is a Mexico song and dance show where they're just inviting some weaker teams over just to get some playing time, and it's a friendly. I mean, 99% of that crowd is going to be hardcore Mexican fans. Ireland did pretty well. Actually, they stayed in the match, though. Some opportunities for some of the younger players to get some playing time. I watched the first 30 minutes on Univision. I enjoyed that. And then for the rest of the game, I switched it over to FS1, and it was JP De La Camera and Kobe Jones commentating on that one. The Champions League final, Kartik, yeah, this one was a little bit difficult for me and for you, because we were both at the garage soccer event in South Florida, which is a table soccer competition. We had a tournament there, and so we had, it was a viewing party too, so we had the UEFA Champions League final on the big screen behind us. So with the kind of the noise in the pub that we're in at that final, it was difficult to hear the actual commentary, but I do have some input in a minute or two from one of our writers. And but what I was able to hear, John Strong sounded great on the call, especially the goal calls during the game. And what a goal by Mandzukic. That was one of the best goals I've ever seen in a UEFA Champions League final. It wasn't even a bicycle kick. It was kind of a hybrid of a volley slash bicycle kick. But that was absolutely incredible to watch. And the crowd went crazy when that went in. From what I could tell, Kate Abdo did a lot more work on this one for Fox Deportes than Fox Sports. And I didn't watch the Fox Deportes coverage, but from what I understand is that she did quite a lot of work. And actually speaks fluent Spanish, which I didn't realize too. So she's, I mean, when you think about it, multi-versatile. I mean, she speaks German fluently, of course, English, Spanish, and I think a couple of other languages too. And so to have an asset like that where you can have somebody that can, I mean, dovetail and kind of jump into the Fox Deportes and feel completely natural doing the Spanish language broadcast as well as the English language broadcast, that's a great find there. Well, it's not that. We all knew she was talented, but it's a great acquisition by Fox. What else was there too? So Kate Abdo for the English language broadcast on Fox, she was on for 67 seconds. And I think that was at the beginning of the show just to kind of kick things off, and then handed it over to Rob Stone. Jeff Shreves, the reporter from Sky Sports who does some reporting for FS1 or Fox in this case, he was on for 55 seconds. Which is interesting because in the press release, they focused, okay, right, it's going to be, you know, we have John Strong and Brad Friedel doing the commentary. We've got Kate Abdo. We've got Jeff Shreves. We've got, I mean, those names are listed, but each of them were on for less than a minute. So since we weren't able to hear the actual coverage, the actual analysis from Fox Sports, we had Oliver Say, one of our writers, provide his analysis on the coverage. And he said the studio pundits tend to focus more on human factors and analysis of individuals in isolation instead of team tactics. Some hardcore viewers may feel a bit empty, but the casual viewers did learn something from the halftime tactical analysis segment done by Warren Barton with the Ronaldo goal, in which Mandzukic was caught having to defend both Carvajal and Ronaldo. And that segment was good enough, given the time limitation and the overall composition of the viewership.
I think Warren Barton's becoming really good at, because he was a defender. They've now, after having him on in the studio since the 2008-2009 Premier League season, so it's been 10 years, basically. I think this is 10th season. They finally isolated his real strength, which is analyzing defensive errors and defensive positioning. And he's really good at it. So he is I'm glad they've done that.
He is good at it, but that's kind of limited, though, Kartik. I mean, if it's a game where you have two attacking teams, and
well, it's too bad he's not covering the Premier League, because there's defensive errors in every Premier League game. I mean, the Champions League is a little higher level. No, seriously, I mean, people are in love with the Premier League. Don't want to admit that, but it's some really bad football. He'd be better off covering that league at this point. Yeah. But go on.
So good. Some good feedback and analysis from Oliver especially in terms of the analysis from Fox Sports, which is focusing on the individuals instead of the team tactics, which is par for the course with Fox. No surprises there. After the Champions League final, Fox did premiere the first episode of their Confederations Cup preview show. So both, I think, Kartik, you missed it, but I missed it. I was at the pub still playing in the table soccer tournament. So here's what Oliver had to say about that, which is the on Fox Sports. And he says that the way that Ali Wagner analyzed Ronaldo as an efficient scientist during the Confederation Cup preview show is an illustration of the strengths and weaknesses of co-commentators and studio pundits who were part of the U.S. Women's National Team pool. Most of these analysts, and that would include Ali Wagner, Kate McGrath, Kat Whitehill, Danielle Slayton, as well as the older generation from the 1990s, such as Brandi Chastain, Julie Foudy, etc., who have all been around the sports TV industry long enough to keep working, tend to read people better than they read defensive tactical basically setups or schemes. So some interesting.
I think that that's a really good observation by Oliver, and I'll tell you why it is. The U.S. in that era, Tony DeCiccio, great coach, okay, not taking anything away from him. The U.S. in that era relied almost exclusively on superior athleticism in the women's game to win games. The tactics were not important. So I think that that is part of the reason why the players who came out of that generation are less tactically attuned and more personality attuned. Now, this generation, obviously, a generation with Abby Wambach, etc. But this generation coming up now, that when Morgan Bryan is a pundit, if she is 10, 15 years from now, or any of the other young U.S. national team players, Crystal Dunn, etc., they might have a completely different perspective because they're playing in an era now where at the national team level, there's a lot more tactical variation and they're having to compete with the likes of France and England and Germany and Sweden, who were really good tactically. And also just NWSL, I think, is a higher level league than WUSA was at the time. So, and Crystal Dunsky, she's playing at Chelsea. So she's playing in England and seeing a lot of other things. But I would attribute that to the era those women played in. And Ali Wagner's a little younger than Kate McGrath and Julie Foudy, but mm-hmm. The U.S. is over-reliance on athleticism. You hear about it all the time.
I would also argue that it's only in the last 8 years, whether across men's or women's soccer, that we've really kind of dived deeper into tactical analysis anyway, since Jonathan Wilson's book and Zonal Marking, the website, in terms of just deep level tactical analysis of matches.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we went from in 2009, around the time of that Champions League final, marveling at how tiki-taka worked. Tiki-taka worked and Pep Guardiola's team and the death by a thousand cuts, to 2010 World Cup when Michael Cox had really launched zonal marking and there was a lot of interest in his thoughts about the World Cup. And then you went into the next season in Europe, the 10-11 season in all the big European leagues, with a different perspective. It's really only been since Michael Cox launched that site. I think it became very tactics became very in vogue, and obviously Jonathan Wilson's inverting the pyramid. I would point out Simon Cooper, who I've talked to from time to time, famous football author, told me that part of the reason for this, I'd ask him this specific question after the 2010 World Cup, was that there was a anti-intellectualism in how the game was covered in the English language up until the late 1990s. And you didn't transition really away from that completely until 2006, 2007, 2008, where you were beginning to look at things a lot more analytically. So it's kind of partially a result of that. So many of the players who played in systems before that are not tactically, maybe as tactically aware, or have not been raised as analysts that way. In Warren Barton's case, he's had to transition into that. So I think his transition has gone quite well. But look, the younger breed of American co-commentators, the Taylor Twelmans, the Kyle Martinos. Martinos exclusively in the studio now, except for once a year. But they are much more tactically aware and tactically able to describe these things than the Alexi Lalases or the Chelo Balboas or the John Harks, et cetera, that previous generation of U.S. players, probably for the same reason. I would point out, though, the psychological factors that the likes of Winalda and Lalas talk about are equally important in many ways.
Sure.
So let's not downplay that. It's just that I think that and when Winalda talks about him, he nails it most of the time. So and he gets tactics too, but those psychological factors are also important. So I don't want to make it sound like we think analysts should be talking tactics 99% of the time and in front of these whiteboards with player movements. There are psychological factors to this game that are just as important.
That's the thing about Winalda, though, too. He's actually able to cover both grounds exceedingly well, both the tactical side and the psychological side, as well as really kind of giving some clear, input in regards to his being a former player and the things that he sees. I mean, but much better able to communicate that than say Warren Barton, unless it's a defensive situation. But I think overall, though, too, with the Champions League coverage for the final from Fox, it was a thumbs up. I don't think there were too many complaints. I think we have one or two in the listener mailbag, but for the most part, it seemed to be well done. And the TV ratings, we'll talk about in a little bit too. Now, Kartik, I saw a little bit of the Toulon tournament, which is the U20 tournament in Europe, featuring many of the some of the best teams from around the world playing there. And one of the matches I watched, actually the whole tournament's been broadcast on beIN Sports. One of the games I saw was Wales against Ivory Coast. And I watched this one. Actually, the football was a good level of football. And again, too, you mentioned a lot of the youth players. There were, I think, one or two Everton players there, some players from Swansea and Coventry, and almost all, I think all of them actually were British Isles players. But it's the first time that Wales has ever played in the U20 Toulon tournament, and the game finished 2-2. Pretty entertaining match, but it wasn't enough for Wales to progress to the semifinals, the next round of the competition. Belgium against Czech Republic. I watched this one on ESPN3 earlier in the week. Commentary by Dave Farrar. This one, the Czechs looked really good. Despite losing 2-1, the Czechs hit the post, I think, two or three times. And Belgium really had a hang on for this one to get a win. I think they've tied most of the matches recently. And Vincent Kompany came back. This is his first match for Belgium since 2015, I believe. And he played most of the first half and seemed to do okay. But he's a long way off full fitness. And then I watched Denmark against Germany. That was the final game I watched this week. Another friendly. The friendlies I've been enjoying just because the level of football has been competitive. It's for Germany. They played.
How was that Germany B team?
Well, it was a lot of names I did not recognize. So might have even been a C team or maybe it's a B team, but not that good, Kartik. Actually, Denmark.
Ralph Honigstein described it as a C team on ESPN FC this week. There, okay. But there are some familiar names in there. But yeah, so we'll go with C team.
Okay, yeah, C team. Yeah, I mean Denmark really controlled this match. I think the Danish team was mostly their starters. So as far as competitive level, the Danes would have had more experience overall. Phil Shane and Ray Hudson were doing the commentary on this one. And actually, it was good to hear Ray back on the airwaves after he took some time off to grieve for the loss of his father back in England. But the match itself was entertaining. Thumbs up. I would definitely recommend checking out this German team. I mean, it's great to watch these German engines, so to speak, with kind of the youth system moving through this conveyor belt. And here's a whole new crop of players that I'm sure some of them will go on to do great things for Germany. All right, Kartik, let's move on. And before we do, I just do want to give a shout out to our sponsor, and that's SeatGeek. buiIN tickets to sports and concerts can be complicated, but there is a better, simpler way to buy, and that's with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to live events. With SeatGeek's seamless mobile experience, you can buy and sell tickets with just two taps. SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. And there's nothing quite like seeing your favorite team or musician in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. I have a SeatGeek app on my phone, and I've used it this year quite a few times. It's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere, and just with a couple of taps, I can instantly find tickets. And I actually just used SeatGeek recently to look for tickets for Swansea's friendlies against Philadelphia, North Carolina, and Richmond. I think it's the North Carolina one I'm probably going to on July 22nd. Now, SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. It saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get to you the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value to help you immediately identify the next seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. Best of all, my listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code WSTPOD today. That's promo code WSTPOD for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Now, Kartik, let's move on to streaming news, and we've got a lot of news this week. Actually, TV streaming news, I should say.
Yeah, there is a lot of news this week, and that's what happens in the early summer months. The EP yesterday saw a story, I believe it was in the EP, about Fox and the 2018 World Cup, where John Strong, Landon Donovan, and Stu Holden will likely be the lead broadcast team, according to David Neal, who's, of course, the executive producer over there. Strong and Holden are going to call the U.S. game on FS1 and on Sunday, and the Confederations Cup coverage you'll get into in a minute. But the headline said that Fox was going to have an all-American broadcast team at the World Cup. Now, I still hesitate to believe this is actually true. That's what the headline I saw wrote. I think they were talking about the lead broadcast team. I saw this originally on Reddit.
Which actually, Kartik, I caught the same thing too, because I saw the headline, and the headline said something along the lines of Fox goes with all-American broadcast team for the World Cup. And then I read the story and I was like, wait a second, this doesn't match with what the headline says. So I'm sure it's one of those things where oftentimes the headline writer is completely separate, a different person than the person that writes the copy. And the person that wrote the copy didn't say in there that it's going to be an all-American crew for the World Cup. It will be an all-American lead crew, kind of a lead commentary crew of John Strong, Landon Donovan, and Stu Holden, probably for the World Cup. And that's
What do you think about the three-man booth, Chris? This is I think we all go back and forth on this. I'm a little bit hesitant about Fox doing this, as I could see for U.S. games, but if that's going to be the lead team, because the U.S. will probably be out of the tournament either at the group stage or the round of 16 like they normally are. So yeah. If they're going through the big matches with three and let's say presumably a fourth who's adding information from the sideline, Katie Whitman or whoever, you wonder how the dynamic is going to work.
Yeah, for me, I'm not a fan of the three-man booth. I'm probably more of a traditionalist, but having said that, though, too, I mean, the three-man booth to me is more of a Spanish language, whether it's Univision or Telemundo, that type of tactic. For some of these Mexico games, I think we've seen like four or five people in the booth. It's really crowded. My issue with the three-man booth is not so much that it's three people, but the selection that they've got. So they've got John Strong, which is great, fantastic, no problem at all. Landon Donovan, I like a lot there. Stu Holden, I like Stu Holden too, but I just think that Stu Holden and Landon Donovan are too similar. And I would rather, nothing against Stu Holden, I think he does a great job, but I'd rather have somebody else, maybe, well, I don't know, I was going to say Ronaldo, somebody different, somebody a different dynamic.
How about just John Strong and Landon Donovan?
Well,
although I have to mention Donovan has worked primarily with JP Delacamera,
exactly.
So we don't know how his dynamic will be with Strong, but I conceptually I think it would be a very good team, very strong.
Yeah, JP and Landon to me is the dream team. that's not going to happen because John Strong's in there. So who do you pair with John Strong? So, and Stu Holden and John Strong together, they're good. They're not amazing. So probably from Fox's perspective, they're probably thinking, okay,
I think just about anyone is good with John Strong. He's really, really good. So yeah. I don't know that they can get that wrong, but I'm wondering maybe Donovan and Del Camera have been a really good team. Donovan is newer at this than everybody else in the group. Although, let's face it, Landon Donovan has had to do far more interviews with media in both English and Spanish, and he's an especially good Spanish speaker, by the way, than Stu Holden or the other guys they have working for Fox that are necessarily former U.S. national team players. Maybe not Brad Friedel. Brad Friedel has done tons of interviews through the years. But I found that interesting. And Friedel is not going to be part of that top team, which I also thought was a little bit interesting. It seems like, maybe we'll transition to Confederations Cup news because he's being paired with J.P. Dale Camera during the Confederations Cup, which makes me think that perhaps that's the team. That's the next team for the World Cup, the second string team, if you will.
Possibly, but just for a moment. So let's stick on this for a moment. So one of the quotes from David Neal, who's the executive producer at Fox, responsible for the World Cup coverage at Fox and previously at NBC Universal, he says, at this moment, that's where we're looking, which is the John Strong, Landon Donovan, Stu Holden. Obviously, we've got 13 months before we have to lock this in. So I think a three-man booth is a good idea. I'm just not sold on Stu Holden in there with John Strong and Landon Donovan. I think there could be somebody else that could step in and then maybe have Stu Holden do games with JP. I mean, Landon should be in there for sure. I just think at this point in time, they're kind of throwing those three guys together, hoping it's going to stick and hoping it's going to work. But even by David Neal's quote, it sounds like there's an opportunity here for somebody to kind of make a run for it, so to speak, and get that third spot. I just don't think it's the ideal trio, at least at this point in time.
Yeah, I don't know, because all three of them have their strengths. We just don't know if the trio together will coalesce. And that's so important, because if you have a weakness in an analyst. Look, I know a lot of other people like Steve McManaman a lot. I don't rate him very highly. And Ian Dark, I think, was able to carry him. To a large extent during the World Cup and the Euros that they did together, and then of course also Premier League when ESPN had Premier League rights. In Taylor Twellman's case, he doesn't need to be carried by anyone. So the dynamic of those two guys together, two guys at the very top of their profession, Dark and Twellman, is magic. But sometimes it may not turn out that way if you have two really good and strong personalities. Those two are strong personalities in the booth.
A lot of it comes down to chemistry. So I see, I mean, Macca and Ian Dark having the perfect chemistry as far as playing off each other, kind of the older gentleman and the younger professional, but just kind of that chemistry between the two of them was perfect. I just don't get that chemistry when I get Landon Donovan, Stu Holden, and John Strong in the booth. I just think that the Stu Holden is the weak link there too. And not in terms of experience or analysis, but just in terms of chemistry. It just doesn't fit. They also sound alike a lot too, Landon and Stu.
Yeah.
Similar.
And they're both soft-spoken. I mean, it's a bit of a different approach, because if you have someone who's as soft-spoken as Donovan was always kind of soft-spoken and would exude confidence, a quiet confidence, but maybe also just a reserved nature in his interviews when he was a player. And Holden is similar. You tend to think you might need a stronger, bombastic personality like a Lawless in the booth with those guys, right?
Yeah.
Or someone else who's going to be or Winalda. Winalda would be the classic example. But they've gone with two soft-spoken individuals, and I think analytically Holden is decent, but I'm not sure he adds a lot more than Donovan. Look, Donovan, Landon Donovan is really good, and he's really good at picking up things tactically watching from the booth.
Yep.
We saw in the Copa America last year on the fly. And that's a skill many co-commentators, many analysts don't have.
That's huge.
So he's got that already. That's huge. I'm not sure Holden adds anything to that. You're exactly talking me into this as we're having this discussion.
Well, speaking of Fox, so Fox has also announced the Confederations Cup talent. So it would have been John Strong, Stuart Holden, and Landon Donovan in a trio in Russia calling Confederations Cup. But Landon Donovan, his wife is expecting, or his partner is expecting a child, so Landon Donovan's not going to be at the Confederations Cup. So it's going to be John Strong and Stu Holden. And they're going to be commentating the games, some of the games from Russia. So they're going to be the Leeds commentary, I guess, duo there. However, Fox's other broadcast of the games is going to be called off the studio, off the monitor in Los Angeles. And they've got JP Della Camera and Brad Friedel, and also, I think, Jorge Perez Navarro and Kobe Jones. And Kate Abdo is going to be providing studio coverage from Russia. While Fox, well, Fox will be based in St. Petersburg, and the analysts they'll have on the set are Lothar Matthäus, Gus Hiddink, pardon me, and Eric Winalda. So far so good. Well, I guess so far so good as far as the studio analysts there in St. Petersburg with Kate Abdo hosting. Matthäus, we'll have to wait and see. Gus Hiddink should be interesting. Winalda, it'll be great to see how Winalda does with Matthäus and Hiddink kind of on the set there. I'm not happy with Fox just sending one team of announcers for... not that this is a big tournament, but this is a big indicator of kind of their intentions for next summer's World Cup coverage, which I'm sure they'll have everyone there for the World Cup coverage. But it's a good opportunity to have their people be there now, but they're deciding not to do that. And then Rob Stone will anchor the LA studio, where it's going to be Alexi Lalas, Arne Friedrich, the former German international, Fernando Fiore, Ali Wagner, and Mariano Trujillo are the analysts there for the LA studio.
I have to say, and we'll get into this next week, and we'll get into this on the site next week. I've spent some time with Telemundo, as you have too, Chris, and their plans are far more, how should I put it? They're sending... Yeah. Okay. There you go.
I didn't want to put words in your mouth, but I mean, to me, it sounds so far from what I've heard more comprehensive, and they're going for it. They're, I mean, sending all of their. Oh, we'll get into it in next week's podcast, but they go into more details. So the one person though, Kartik, who's been omitted from this Fox list, which I think is quite enlightening, someone who's been snubbed and knocked off the pecking order, is Ian Joy. Ian Joy is not on this list.
Is that because of NYCFC or?
I don't think so. I think, I mean, as far as with Kate Abdo coming in and then kind of him getting knocked off the Bundesliga coverage, except for when Kate's not available, I think he's just gone down the pecking order for whatever reason. I know from a Fox's perspective, I think they're pushing the US angle, the American angle pretty heavy. But then again, though, too, you have... I guess Kate Abdo hosting the studio sets in St. Petersburg, and you've got, I mean, Lothar Matthäus, Gus Hiddink, and you got Winalda there. Maybe Ian Joy could have been there instead of Winalda, but Winalda's, to me, a better analyst at that level. I guess it's just they haven't been able to find a spot for him.
So, okay, I find it odd when you have a guy that's that versatile and that knowledgeable about different leagues and different levels of soccer that you wouldn't find a use for him. Now, I assume that's because Confederations Cup isn't the World Cup. Let's see what happens a year from now. But yeah. I would be very disappointed in Fox if Ian Joy is not featured in somewhat of a prominent role on their World Cup coverage. I would be stunned, actually. I think that this is because it's Confederations Cup and MLS is playing through the Confederations Cup. I think that it has to do with that. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I was disappointed with that. I mean, Ian Joy, for those who don't know, he is American. He was born in the United States. I think he grew up in San Diego. He's played in the, I think, NASL or USL. I think he played for
Portland. Portland in the USL, yeah. Right, and right. USSFT2 League, yeah. Right.
So even though he has a Scottish accent, he's American through and through. So in other news, Kartik, what's going on with Fox Deportes? Any big announcements this week?
Yeah, so they've got back the rights from CONMEBOL for Sudamericana and Libertadores, and that's a very, very big deal because it's also a big deal for me. It was much more accessible for me to watch Libertadores. I have all these friends of mine who say, oh, you didn't watch the Copa Lib last night? Well, it was difficult for me to find. So it's going to be back on Fox Deportes. And this is a huge driver of ratings when Mexican teams are in the tournament. Now, the Copa Libertadores has not been won by a Mexican team yet. But Mexican teams have gotten to the final often, and it's just some good football. Yep. And so it's great that it's going to be back on kind of a mainstream platform. Copa Sudamericana is more like Europa League. Not really that interesting. Once upon a time, MLS teams competed in it. Well, we haven't had an MLS team down there since DC United, I believe, in 2007 or 2008. Mm-hmm. As the MLS champions, they went down there, Supporter Shield winners. So it's good, though. It's good to have this back on US TV, on Fox, the Fox networks.
Yeah, and the Copa Lib, the second stages or the final stages of the tournament kicks off in July 4th. Unfortunately, no Mexican teams.
Oh, I should point that out. That's part of the benefit of Copa Lib, is that the finals are during the summer when Europe is shut down.
Right.
So it gives you something to watch if you have nothing else to watch. Look, I mean, if people are in the U.S., they should be watching our domestic leagues, but I know in large part they're not. So this gives you something to watch.
Yeah, plus the passion from the crowds. I mean, just definitely electric atmospheres there. In other news, so here's another example of how soccer is the sport of the future in the U.S., which I think, I don't know, I think it's a little bit condescending to say that. I think it is a sport now. It's a top four sport in the U.S. and will continue to grow in the future. But according to new research published by Sports Business Journal, soccer is the youngest median TV audience age. So the average ages of people that watch La Liga is 39. International soccer is 39. Major League Soccer is 40. The NBA, 42. So the NBA is the youngest median age of TV watching in the U.S. for an American traditional sport. EPL is 43. NFL is 50. And Major League Baseball is 57. So you're looking at the soccer, which is anywhere from 39 to 43. NFL is 50. Major League Baseball is 57. So why does this matter? So for advertisers, this is huge, because the 18-year-old to 49-year-old male demographic is the sweet spot for advertisers. That's what they're looking at in terms of all the big media buys on television and streaming now these days too. Anyone younger or older than that age range, advertisers aren't interested in, because usually the 18 to 49 is people with more disposable income. They're more willing to buy products and services and that is the sweet spot. So if you're within that 18 to 49 range, you're doing great. Major League Baseball, 57 average age is average median age is that's bad news, because I mean that number is continuing to grow year over year, and just shows that there's far fewer younger people that are really watching baseball. It's more of your father's generation or your grandfather's generation that continue to watch baseball. Of course, there's new younger fans coming in, but not at the rate of soccer. So that's good news for the soccer industry in the U.S.
Yes, it is, no doubt. And I think it shows kind of what we had basically assumed about median age and the demographics trending younger for the sport.
Totally. So last but not least, two big stories from the streaming world this week. And that's first is that PlayStation View has dropped beIN Sports and beIN Sports en Español from its programming as of June 8th. And that's a huge blow to soccer fans who had View, who wanted to watch La Liga games as well as World Cup qualifiers from CONMEBOL, etc. No reason was given by PlayStation View why they decided to remove beIN Sports. But for View subscribers, this is a huge blow. As we know, I mean, beIN Sports provides, I mean, they have so many rights. I mean, so many different competitions. It's for a soccer fan, it's a must have. And then second and lastly, Fubo TV has added a new feature. It's called Look Back, and it's a on-demand programming functionality feature, very similar to that. And the way it works is that for the past 72 hours, so for example, if there's a game this weekend, say it's the Mexico against the US game on Sunday, and you miss it, you're out partying, and you forget to set the DVR on Fubo to record it. So up to 72 hours after that game, at any point, you can go back in, and on the homepage on Fubo, you can go back in, click on the calendar, and you can go back in time for 72 hours and catch that game and watch it, the whole game, just hit play and off you go. So that's a great feature. It's not available at this moment for every single channel that Fubo has, but it is available for all the major soccer networks. So it has FS1, FS2, beIN Sports, beIN Sports en Español, and I think there's a couple other ones too, but it's on the website. We've got more information at worldsoccertalk.com. So definitely check that out if you're a Fubo subscriber. Kartik, let's move on to TV ratings and a big one. UEFA Champions League final last weekend, and that was on Fox, and that had 1.76 million viewers there, plus 1.2 million viewers on Fox Deportes, for a combined total of just over 3 million viewers. What's your thoughts on that one?
It's a similar number to last year. It's a good number. This is the ultimate showcase in football. It is actually better football than the World Cup final, or it should be. So I'd love to see the numbers continue to grow. Fox has put it on platforms where it can grow. Let's see what Turner does when they get the rights in a year. Let's hope that doesn't lead to a decline in visibility and ratings for the final.
Yeah, and it could do because, it'll be, I guess 2 years from now. So they'll start the coverage 2018 summer, like August. But, with Fox having, over-the-air coverage access, Turner, I guess, would not, right? Turner would not have any over-the-air access. So that would be, a huge blow there too. But, I mean...
That having been said, we don't know what their coverage plans are for the tournament itself, but TNT and TBS and True TV are far more kind of in, maybe less so True TV, but the other two are far more in people's consciousness to find sporting events at and just programming in general than FS1 and FS2.
Yeah.
So
TBS would
might take a step back in the final, but you need to take a step forward in the rest of the tournament.
That's true. Some of the
Of course, Univision, which has a greater scope than Fox Deportes, so that's an offset there.
Yeah. I actually didn't think about that because Univision will have this, have it 2018 onwards. Univision over the air final would be absolutely massive, I'm sure. And actually, the good news about this number too is that as we've seen from NFL and other sports too, EPL included, TV numbers this season are down compared to last season. A lot of it is because of cord cutting. And these numbers are actually just a little bit more than last year's by about 3,000 viewers. But still, that's progress, and that's a good news there for the soccer folks at Fox. So some other numbers that jumped out this week. We don't have all the numbers in yet. We will publish them at worldsoccertalk.com when they're available. 1.5 million people tuned in for the Mexico against Ireland friendly on Unimas. That one doesn't include the Univision Deportes number. The Venezuela-USA friendly, the 1-1 draw, that was, what was it? It was 492,000 people watched it on FS1 and 838,000 people watched it on Univision. Again, that doesn't include the Univision Deportes number. So over 1.2, 1.3 million there, plus some other numbers to come in too.
I'm struck always by the number of people who watch games on Univision Deportes when matches are on Univision over the air. And maybe our listeners can give us some feedback on this. Is it because you're in a market where you don't have a Univision over the air network? Is it just familiarity? You go to that channel a lot for MLS games and Liga MX games. So you go to it also for these national team games that are on both. I shouldn't say I'm confused by that. I'm just find it fascinating.
Yeah. It's definitely curious on that one. And then some of the other numbers, MLS, we had Portland against San Jose on Unimas on Friday. Again, this doesn't include the Univision Deportes number, but had almost 290,000 viewers. Sporting KC against Minnesota on ESPN, and that one had 256,000 viewers. And then Orlando against Chicago, the debacle, that one had 211,000 on FS1. So,
I've been watching Ted Uncle for the official for 7 or 8 years. In fact, he was an official in the NASL when I worked in the NASL, our very first ceremonial game with our ball, Fort Lauderdale against Tampa Bay. He lives in the Tampa area, by the way. He was the official, so I have some pictures with him. I don't know if he's going to be able to officiate another Orlando City game. And, of course, he's kind of local, so you don't want to fly your referees all over the country. Boy, what a debacle that game was. So Fortunate that only 211,000 people viewed it, which is less than the other nationally televised MLS games this weekend, because it was a bad advert for the league. So I'm glad very few people, not just for the league, just for the standard of officiating everything in U.S. soccer. I'm very glad that, and fan rowdiness, all of that stuff. I'm glad that not that many people watched game, honestly.
Hopefully video assistant referee technology will catch that in the future.
Well, it's coming.
It's coming, right.
It's coming very soon. And the Ramos red card was rescinded by MLS. The Nocturino one, I don't believe Orlando City appealed. So I guess that's going to stick. But for those who don't know, Orlando played much of the game with nine men, which last season I was at the game when these two teams played at the Citrus Bowl, and Chicago got a ridiculous red card. And I believe Ted Uncle might have been the official that night, too. I think he was. Got an official red card, got a ridiculous red card early in the match, and had to play the match out with 10 men and also got a 1-1, a draw in that game. So this fixture, for some reason, each season, there's some dodgy officiating and fan controversies and such. So maybe Orlando shouldn't play Chicago anymore.
Yeah. Overall, though, for Major League Soccer, so you do see a little bit of a bump now that the European seasons are over. So we've got in the 200,000s. So that's a good sign. That's hopefully that'll continue to grow over the coming weeks.
Hopefully that sustains itself. I mean, I think it would really help if the U.S. qualified for the Confederations Cup, which they obviously almost did, losing an extra time to Mexico in that playoff match, because I think that would have really given the bump to MLS with an MLS-heavy squad that the U.S. has now. Unlike Mexico, and we've talked about this, Mexico is going to the Confederations Cup with probably their most European-heavy squad they've ever had. So they're kind of going the reverse. They're having more and more guys leave Liga MX in the primes of their careers, whereas the U.S. is having fewer and fewer guys outside their domestic league in the full national team. That will change, as we saw the U.S. U-20 team that performed pretty well at the U-20 World Cup is largely a team made up of guys that have come through MLS academies and moved abroad, or are guys that have are already abroad.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's move on to listener mailbag. The first comment is through Twitter, and that's from John Arder. He says that Brad Friedel is so bad. Will he be the main guy on the World Cup coverage in 18? Well, we already answered that one. He's not going to be the main guy, and it's going to be most likely Landon Donovan and Stu Holden as the co-commentators there. But Brad Friedel, I guess his style is definitely very monotone, very flat. But if you do listen to what he has to say, oftentimes there's some good analysis there. But obviously not a favorite there with John. The next one is from Steve, and this is he posted this on worldsoccertalk.com. He says, Kartik, will you talk in some future pod about MLS, NWSL scheduling matches during the Champions League final? I missed seeing the winning NYCFC goal because I switched to Juve against Real Madrid, like most soccer fans around the world. Who runs our U.S. soccer leagues, and do they actually follow soccer?
Look, I thank you for the question, Steve. I maybe we should have mentioned it earlier in the podcast. I have to say this has been a major topic of conversation during the course of the week for people I talk to, and everybody's kind of annoyed by it. There was a nationally televised NWSL game. They're always in the same time slot on Lifetime, so maybe give them a pass on that. There were two MLS games, two or three MLS games that overlapped. Now the NYCFC Philly game being the most prominent because it overlapped. The end of it overlapped with the first half of the Champions League final. So I don't know. I don't get it. And it's very odd to me because this is the same thing that we've seen happen time and again with Major League Soccer. They've gotten better about their scheduling, but I remember the time Seattle was playing a game in 2009 while the U.S. was in the Confederations Cup final against Brazil. Now, the Brazilian League had taken an executive order, even though it was only the Confederations Cup, to postpone every league game that day to other days. But Seattle, and it was their first year after moving up from U.S., so they played the game. They kicked off the game while the U.S. was fighting for their lives. Remember, they were up 2-0 in that game and gave up three goals in the second half to Brazil. It's very odd. And there have been other cases of this. I mean, that was 8 years ago, but there have been other cases since. So bizarre.
So Clayton Davis sent in an email. He says, listen to your great podcast. I would love a two-season year in Major League Soccer, like Liga MX and the NASL, although the schedule would be even more unbalanced than it is now due to the large number of teams, which I'm willing to accept. There does need to be less travel in MLS. I don't know if there are enough population centers in the Deep South in the United States to have two strong leagues at different times of the year. I think he's alluding to the Northern League and Southern League idea. He says it would have to be the Deep South that would play in the winter, Florida, Texas, and Southern California. I think the Southern League would be like the size of the NASL now, maybe a little bit bigger. Can you imagine MLS without LA Galaxy, Orlando, and FC Dallas? So it's a good point there too, Carter, because I think he's talking about the Northern League and Southern League idea. So if you do had a Southern League that plays during the wintertime and the Northern League that plays during the summertime, and you figure out a way to kind of match them up and have a championship playoff series, that you would, for the Northern League, be missing LA Galaxy, Orlando, and FC Dallas, three of some of the – Atlanta, too, I'd add to that, four of the yeah. some of the most exciting teams in Major League Soccer right now. There's no easy solution.
Right, there is no easy solution, and I think unfortunately the weakest MLS markets are—it's an imbalance. It's leans towards bigger markets in the Northeast and the Midwest. The Northeastern markets plus Chicago are the weakest markets for MLS right now. So there is no easy answer. There is no easy solution. But as those of us who live in Florida can tell you, the last week has demonstrated why it's very difficult to play through the summer months in the state. I, as the former NASL communications director, have to deal with countless numbers of postponements, delays, all of that stuff with Tampa Bay games, Fort Lauderdale games, and Carolina Railhawks games, and Atlanta games when we had an Atlanta team, Silverbacks. So it's just the weather in the Southeast is prohibitive to playing this time of year, and because of the climate in the North, you have to play through this these months, and it's very, very much dictated by the New York media market, Chicago, the large cities of this country. At the time when these things were conceived, were all Northeast and Midwest. Population has shifted south, but I don't think the thinking has shifted south with it.
Right. So last week's pod, we talked about Liga MX and some of the lessons that MLS could learn from how well the league is doing, both off the pitch as well as on the pitch. And Pedro from so actually he posted this on the website worldsoccertalk.com. He says, you guys missed the underlying and the very important story to the Liga MX final, and I believe that that is what it made it more of an interesting and appealing matchup, and that is the foreign filled player filled Tigres against the all-Mexican Chivas, along with Guadalajara, reaching the final after an 11-year dry spell. So, yeah. I think...
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, too, because Liga MX, it's, I mean, a league that we've known about for quite a long time, of course, and catch the occasional game here and there. For me, personally, it's only within the last couple of years that I've paid a lot more closer attention to the league as it's grown in popularity. And as when I've watched it, I mean, I've been watching it for a couple of decades at least, seen the odd occasional game, but in the last couple of years I've been seeing more of the games and they've been impressing me more and more. So it's great, I think, for Pedro to add that perspective, something that a newer viewer to Liga MX such as myself would not have known. So Kartik, so if any listeners, do you have any questions?
Well, real quickly, sure. You have to be quickly with how you present that argument, because I think what I went through a decade ago and 8 years ago were a lot of Chivas fans, a lot of Guadalajara fans saying America and Cruz Azul and all these teams, they're dependent on America at the time, especially, and Pachuca are dependent on these South American imports and the occasional guy from Europe, like obviously Tigres has got Gignac. We're a pure team. We're a pure Mexican team, and using it kind of in xenophobic terms. So I'm always very weary of the Chivas argument against other clubs in Mexico who are, quote, foreign-filled. That having been said, I respect Chivas's integrity and their purity and their principles. I like clubs in Europe that do things like that. I mean, I'm a big fan of what Athletic Bilbao does, but I don't necessarily like it broadcast against the other guys who are bringing in players from South America, especially, and then in Tigres's case, a prominent European player as well.
So if listeners do have any feedback, questions, and comments, send us those to us, and we'll read them out on air. The email address is web at worldsoccertalk.com. Twitter is WSoccerTalk, and Facebook is facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. So, Kartik, we're moving on to our featured topic of the week, and that is the big news this week, which midweek, I think it was on Tuesday, or Wednesday, the week's going by so quickly, actually Tuesday, Miami commissioners had a meeting, and they approved the opportunity for Beckham to go ahead and get the final piece of land in Overtown, Miami, downtown Miami, in order to have all the land that they need to go ahead and build a stadium. So what's left now is that the city of Miami has to approve it, and then Major League Soccer has to approve the stadium plan. But a massive hurdle has been overcome, especially from the kind of the local, I guess, vociferous kind of feedback on why a lot of the local residents didn't want to have the stadium there. But it passed. So now we're looking at how a Beckham, Miami Beckham United, or whatever the name will be of this team, how this will impact Major League Soccer in the future, if it does become so. And to get your insight in terms of what are some of the benefits to Major League Soccer of having a team in Miami, following up on a story that you wrote this week too on the Florida Squeeze on your website that goes into a lot more detail.
Yeah, so I've kind of come around a little bit on this Miami to MLS issue, because I've realized that it has a lot to do with external non-South Florida related factors. It has to do with the important MLS television contracts, MLS's media presence, their ability to take players when they visit the area and take them to Telemundo and BN and Univision and everybody else whose large media operation and large football operation is based out of South Florida. It has a lot to do with presence overseas, the ability to attract foreign players, high-profile foreign players to Major League Soccer. If you have a team in Miami, which is considered a destination for many in Europe and in Latin America, you can see Italian players, Cristiano Ronaldo, those types of players wanting to live in Miami. The market itself, I remain skeptical as to I think MLS will have similar struggles here as they've had in Philadelphia, not in year one in Philadelphia, but after that, and similar struggles to what they've had in Chicago since Peter Wilt left that organization in 2005, and the sorts of struggles that at times the Los Angeles Galaxy have had, quite frankly, in spite of their attendance numbers, getting penetration among the local sports fans, getting penetration among the local media, not that Hispanic-dominant national and international media I talked about a minute ago. I think those challenges still remain. I don't think it's a very good market for professional soccer. That's been proven by what's happened at the NASL level. The Fort Lauderdale Strikers, who I worked with, who I worked with as a striker consultant, I worked with from the NASL level, have now gone on hiatus. Their attendance declined just about every single season. The first year they were in NASL in 2011, they had the best attendance of any team that wasn't moving to MLS, Montreal being the team in the league that was moving to MLS. And gradually the other six teams that were below them at the time passed them in attendance, and the attendance declined as the novelty wore off. I think Miami FC, which is playing in the market now, has largely inflated attendance numbers because of concerts and other things. They're doing a good job with what they've got, but it's a situation where no one really cares about minor league soccer. There's no intensity to that fan base. There's no buzz about the club. The soccer market is very fragmented. We have seven teams between NPSL and PDL in this area. Most parts of the country, even if they have a Major League Soccer team, have two, maybe three teams in PDL or NPSL, if even that. I mean, I'm thinking the New York area has about the same number between PDL and NPSL as South Florida does, but South Florida has one-fourth the population or one-third the population of Greater New York. So, and I think we have more NPSL and PDL teams probably than the LA metropolitan area. So that tells you how fragmented the soccer base is here, because everybody is an expert, everybody has some local ties to South Florida, and they want to start their own clubs. And on top of that, we have the issue of the elephant in the room, which is Stephen Ross and the Miami Dolphins and Relevant Sports and their ability to continuously bring one or two big ICC games to the area, charge high ticket prices, and basically force people to make a choice choice. You want to see Real Madrid in person, or do you want to see MLS in person? I think a lot of people will choose Real Madrid. That all having been said, I've turned around on this, thinking now MLS needs to get this done because of those other factors. I realize their insistence on being back in Miami has very little to do with the local market. All the things I outlined, they're well aware of in MLS HQ. Don Garber and Mark Abbott know what I just said about the market. It tends to be true, but there are other reasons they need it, especially with a guy like David Beckham. You put David Beckham's face on this franchise, on this club, you get worldwide media and you get worldwide attention. So the marriage of Miami and Beckham is good for MLS.
Yeah, I've been down on this a little bit too, on some of the stories I've posted on worldsoccertalk.com. It's been a while since I've done one, but from this point, when it started about 4 years ago, when Beckham was going to the Miami Heat games and was making a very visible presence there and spending lots more time in Miami. And then about 3 years ago, I believe it was, for the press conference that they announced that they were launching this team. Since then, it's been one disaster after another, and it's really been it couldn't have gone worse in terms of the way that this club and everything they've gone through to get to where they are today. As of today, they look like they're in a good spot. They've brought in Tim Nowicki and a whole bunch of other professionals to really hone this down and make it happen. So I'm a lot more optimistic and positive on it now than I was in the past when they first announced it. I'm a little bit more, I think, confident, Kartik, than you are in terms of attendance. You mentioned the examples of Chicago, LA Galaxy, and Philadelphia Union. And each of those three teams are playing outside the city. They're playing in Bridgeview or Chester or Carson. Even though this is in Overtown, it's close to downtown Miami. In terms of the transportation, it's going to be a little bit sticky to get to for some people coming from Broward or Palm Beach County. They're going to have to probably take tri-rail or drive down and go into a parking garage at the northern part of the city and then take metro rail or some other method of buses to get to the game. But I'm confident that with the population size and with the pent up, it's been 16 years since there's been a top flight team in the Miami market. This is going to be massive. In the beginning, it's going to be a huge buzz. And then hopefully if it's a winning team, that fans will continue to come back. My thing, though, Kartik, is on this one is I think the big question and the big thing that's floating out there is that if you're a Honda or a Procter & Gamble or, say, a Volkswagen, and you're talking to Major League Soccer and you're saying, okay, hey, well, we're talking about this big media buy. We're interested in becoming a sponsor with Major League Soccer. Okay, let's talk about all the different cities that Major League Soccer is in. Okay, Los Angeles, New York, you mean Chicago, etc. What about Miami? We don't have a team in Miami. Oh, so when you think about it, too, in terms of a TV market, the size of Miami, not only the size of Miami, Fort Lauderdale area TV market, but how often in the most viewed World Cup games, the most viewed Premier League games, most viewed La Liga games, most of that, well, not most of it, but a lot of it is Miami's usually number one, number two, or number three in those markets. It's a very, very soccer-centric market with no team. Yes, there will be challenges. Yes, it will be difficult. But I believe this will be a success. And if anything, from Major League Soccer, which is why they've had so much patience on this, that they didn't pull the plug a long time ago, they have to be in this market in order to be, from a business perspective, to be a player with a major brand to say, okay, yes, we're going to get your brand out there. We're going to have lots of viewers tuning in to watch games from the Miami area. And that's going to hopefully give us a boost in the TV numbers too. But I see this as a big TV/business play for Major League Soccer. And hopefully the team will do well too and go on to bigger and better things. But that's my thoughts on MLS's perspective on this one.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. So that makes a lot of sense. I think sponsorship, you, when you talk to sponsors and you get sponsors at the table, that's a big part of it. And so it's important for people listening to this, and I think we've kind of exhausted the arguments here, but it's important for them to understand this is a lot about a lot more than local attendance. This is about a lot more than local fan support. Now, when you put a team in Salt Lake City, or when you put a team in Orlando, or you put a team in in potentially Cincinnati, it's all about the attendance. It's all about the local buzz. And that's fair, and that's fair for those markets. I think the reason, as you said, MLS has been so patient with Miami is that they're external factors. This is the reason MLS forced that second team in New York when there really wasn't much demand for it. I will say I don't think there's a whole lot of demand in South Florida for Major League Soccer, but they're going to force the issue, and they're going to force the issue for issues largely unrelated to the local market and to the local demand in the soccer market.
And with having it be in Miami too, and in terms of trying to get some of these players, whether it's Zlatan, who's mentioned he's interested in Miami in the past. I mean, you can get probably any of the big names from around the world in the latter stages of their career if they want to go down that path. But Miami would be one of probably in the top three locations where players would want to continue playing their playing career after they've finished at Man United or Real Madrid or wherever. I mean, Miami is the go-to place, and a lot of the soccer stars come over here on vacation. They're vacationing here now when they have time off. So it is a destination for the athletes, which should give them an opportunity to sign some big names.
Well, if you sign Zlatan, you'll win a trophy, right? Because that's just generally the pattern, right? Wins league titles. He wins cup competitions wherever he goes. So maybe Miami needs to hurry up and make sure they get Zlatan before he retires.
So I'm sure this week MLS HQ in New York City, they were doing some high fives. This is a huge relief in terms of this team now taking a giant step forward. Still a long way to go to get this all set up, and hopefully by 2020 looks like this team will have a stadium built and ready to kick off. Perhaps, well, 2020 is not that far away when you think about it. Kartik, what does this mean for Tampa Bay and St. Petersburg and their push for Major League Soccer?
Well, I think they're behind anyway in terms of some of the other expansion possibilities for 2020. They're not that far out. Right now, I've got San Antonio, San Diego, Sacramento, Raleigh, Durham, Phoenix ahead of them, and Cincinnati. So they're seventh. Four teams are going to get in. There's any number of things that could happen between all those markets as we go forward. But I think the perception is it hurts them. At the same time, it may actually help them because then you have three teams in real close proximity if they're added, and you've got natural rivals. You've got kind of a Cascadia thing going on in Florida with three teams, Tampa Bay, Orlando, and Miami. Now, Tampa Bay and Orlando already have a rivalry, even though they've never been in the same league. They played in U.S. Open Cup matches. They played in friendly matches, and the fan rivalry is off the charts. Those two teams are about 90 miles from each other. So that rivalry is already there. Now, as far as Miami, that would be a third wheel in established rivalry, but it would probably happen because of close proximity to both markets and the historic rivalry that teams from Fort Lauderdale or Miami have had with the Rowdies through the years.
And that's the thing about Miami, Kartik, that sometimes I forget, though, but there's a lot of people out there that hate Miami. There's a very heavy anti-Miami bias.
We see that there's in the media, too. I mean, look, LeBron James got criticized to no end for signing in Miami. If he had signed with the New York Knicks, and I'm going to offend a lot of people here, if he had signed with the New York Knicks, they'd be talking about what a hero he was, how great the greatest player of a generation going to the most important city to try and lift that city out of its doldrums and win a title there. But because he signed with Miami, there was this resentment that followed him for the 4 years he was with the Miami Heat, and this anti-Miami thing going on throughout the country. So, and that was the first time I realized how powerful it was when LeBron signed here instead of signing with the Knicks.
Yeah, for me,
I think that'll continue.
For me, though, Kartik, it's been from a soccer perspective in terms of some of the stories we've written about Miami in the past. This is going back in the last 10 years now. There was always a lot of it was MLS fans, like a huge anti-Miami bias where they just would just hate on Miami.
Right, it was an anti-Florida bias, and then the Orlando thing kind of cured that. Although, yeah. Again, I think that there's this general assumption that there's I think now we're past it, but even year one, there was this assumption among other MLS fans, oh, well, Orlando's attendance will eventually fade. Yep. It's Florida. It's transient. It's summertime. And all of that is true. It's transient. It's summertime. There are other things to do. There are a lot of other things to do in Orlando, but they have a hardcore fan base. But I hear some of those same concerns about Tampa Bay. Oh, there are other things to do there. Mm-hmm. The market has failed before. I think it was generally an anti-Florida bias, but it's more a Miami thing. You're right.
And the reason I mentioned that, too, is that in terms of TV ratings, if and when Miami does launch in 2020 or around then, there will be people that will watch and tune in to the games just to hope that Miami loses, to hope that they go down in flames. I mean, maybe not in flames, but definitely have a tough time. So that adds a different dimension to the league, and actually maybe that'll help TV ratings. You've got people tuning in to cheer Miami Beckham United on, and others hoping that they fail.
Right. There are no real villain teams in MLS. Now, look, I think a lot of us don't like dealing with Seattle fans, and Orlando has kind of become similar. I have different experiences with Orlando because I'm a Floridian, but I do realize why people dislike Orlando and dislike their fans. But there's no real villain team. The thinking was maybe NYCFC would turn into that, but it hasn't really happened. So maybe Miami turns into that team, and once you have that villain team, there are people who turn on games on NBC so that they can watch Manchester United lose. We know this is the case, even though we don't have any empirical data about it. There are people who will turn on BN so that they can watch Real Madrid lose. So MLS probably needs that team at some point, and it's it hasn't developed it, partly because of their insistence on parity. The reasons we hate some clubs are because of their fans. Like I said, Seattle and Orlando stick out in that regard. Look, when I have to tell you, Seattle, it's been going on since they were in the lower divisions. When they were in USL 12, 15 years ago, fans of the opposing teams hated Seattle because of their fans. So it's that's been a consistent thing. But MLS needs that kind of pantomime villain, right? Maybe it's Beckham in Miami.
Yep, Miami could be it. So Kartik, where can listeners find you on the internet?
You can find me at KKFLA737 on Twitter.
Okay, guys. So, well, thanks for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday or Friday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, Audio Boom, and WorldSoccerTalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review. And Kartik, what should they do?
Enjoy your football.